Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Hello, and welcome to Strange Studies of Strange Stories. It's the Feedback Show.
Putting Draculas in your vernaculars since 2009. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. We are talking about stories from Marches for Dracula. Or rather, you are.
It's an inversion of a twist. An upside-down surprise that you didn't see coming. Much like the mysteries that we encountered in Clark Ashton Smith's story, The Black Abbot of Puthoom.
Richard Horseman writes, I remember ages ago on one of your earliest live shows, someone asked what you were going to do when you ran out of Lovecraft stories. Andrew was there and strongly suggested, do the letters, do the letters. Voluminous was still a few years away, but I like to think that's where the idea was born. So it's a nice resolution for you all to have this crossover now. Looking forward to the next episode.
Yeah, I hope folks drove across the street to listen to that episode of Voluminous that accompanied that show. I kind of think it was better than our show.
Yeah.
I had more fun doing it.
Yeah.
I don't know what that means. I remember Andrew saying that at that live show, do the letters. I remember that now.
Nom Nom Daguerre writes, the way you guys described this story reminded me of a run of Elder Scrolls V Skyrim RPG because A, there are Dracs in the world. B, I roleplayed class who didn't use anything magical and main weapon was bow and arrow. Tempted to look up these stories now. P.S. I'm a little disappointed there wasn't any podcast rivalry going on during this episode. LOL.
Well, not during the episode.
No.
You know, afterward I got into it with Lehman again.
Oh, it got ugly.
He's like, DeLoreans are the coolest car. I was like, nuh-uh, Lamborghinis. What's wrong with you?
Yeah, it wasn't pretty.
Ben A. writes, I love that you all are doing crossover shows with Sean and Andrew, and I'm excited to see you all visit the Zothiek store at the Weird Fiction Mall again. I forgot about that. Chad, I'm going to have to push back on the theme of the podcast being that staying home is the safest option. While I agree the majority of the tales you've covered feature the perils of being away from home, recent examples include The Landlady, The Bus, The Horror at Chilton Castle, and Thurnley Abbey. Yeah! I'd counter that some of the most disturbing tales are those that take place at home. Think of the children in Child's Play, the wave of violence that comes crashing from abroad in the Screwfly solution, or the mysterious terror witnessed from afar in The Nightwire. Even The Chestnut Beads, uneven as I think that tale is, confronts nuclear apocalypse at home. Mm. My take home from the show is simply that the weird and terrible will find you anywhere.
Oh, man.
Well, thanks, Ben.
Zing, Pfeiffer.
Yeah.
Eat it.
And I'm scared now.
Jeff Hall writes, this is my favorite CAS story. And I've read them all. Bummed to hear you guys didn't like it. Maybe I just have a soft spot for the gurgling eunuchs. But seriously... As with so much of CAS fiction, it's really all about the atmosphere. As an author, Clark Ashton Smith was much less interested in plot and characterization than he was in setting and mood. You know how those poets are.
I do. Mm-hmm. Carver writes, I have been a huge CAS fan for years and have been consistently bummed by how much this guy's legacy has been defined by critical disdain. Mm. Even in my copy of Supernatural Horror and Literature, which contains some high Clark Ashton Smith praise from Lovecraft, the editor makes a point in the intro to call Lovecraft's love of CAS puzzling. Well, it's not puzzling to me. A bit like extreme metal music, CAS is a vibe that once you absorb it, you'll find that nothing else quite matches. Mm. People, I think, were a little bummed out that we didn't like the story so much.
Yeah.
It was this story, though. I do like his stuff quite a bit. And I had to get on there. I was, like, getting mad about it. I was like, hey, hold on, guys. We like Clark Ashton Smith. Just to remind you, in 2021, we did a full feature-length adaptation of The Colossus of Elor, and that's how much we're into
exactly. So. We haven't done that with the Lovecraft story.
No.
So, suck that.
See, now we're getting some rivalry on this podcast. This is the conflict you were all looking for.
There you go. Jim Cannon writes, speaking of bugbears, that black mist made me think of these poor bastards wandered into Ravenloft. Of the big three, I think Clark Ashton Smith would have been the better DM. He was so good at setting and mood and had such a dark sense of humor. Howard would have annoying game master characters, and Lovecraft would fiddle so much with the setting we would never actually run a game.
That's totally true. Yeah.
And that brings us to Study 34, Revelations in Black. Quantum Chaos writes, thanks so much. I have Revelations in Black stuck in my brain now. Yeah, dude, for a week afterwards, I kept going, Revelations in Black. I'm having a heart attack.
Well, if that did get stuck in your head, I think it means you have your own black revelations to confront.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah.
Michelle Albert writes, I was thinking that the vampires are stuck on the property for some other reason, and the book is just a magical door dash. So she prepares the journals, and then the spell is put into them. Also, I feel like Giovanni might have been lying about how it was written. Perhaps he's some kind of Renfield type and serves the vampires so they don't snack down on him. Mm. If the vampires are chained to the spot, who's coming at night to drain his blood? Creepy little Giovanni? That's who. Creepy little Giovanni. He said he didn't want to sell the books to the guy, but loans them, getting some cash out of it, even though he couldn't possibly sell them, and then takes his eyes off the obsessed guy while the third is just sitting around unsecured. Sounds fishy to me. Yeah.
Yeah, Michelle is really trying to help the story along, but accidentally just kind of wrote a better story, I think, in that comment.
Yep.
Lewis Davies writes, when the Vampire the Masquerade role-playing game came out, some of the very earliest supplements had this weird feel to them where they hadn't worked out how much fantasy-style magic went into a gothic punk role-playing game. And this story felt like one of those scenarios. It did.
Jim Cannon writes, that vampire dog was kind of a pushover. What happened to all his vampire superpowers? And how do you choke that which has already been choked? Hmm? That was a pretty fun story with a good gimmick. Chekhov's tripod. And a delightfully clueless protagonist. And I do love a sudden info dump. A vacation in Southern Europe, a gun in the pocket because of a holdup in East Providence, etc. David Halstead wrote, I couldn't help picturing Pearl as Nadia from What We Do in the Shadows.
Yeah, ditto. I was definitely thinking of her. Camshaft writes, eyes as large as the ends of big spoons? Wow, Americans really will do anything to avoid using the metric system. I like the metric system and wish that we would adopt it.
Oh, yeah. You're always talking about it. Just shut up about the metric system, for Christ's sake.
Me?
Yeah, you. Jeez. You're the only guy I know that says decimeters and decameters. Mm-hmm. You actually use that mm-hmm. as a system of measurement.
What's wrong with that?
No, it's fine. You're right. I mean, it's It's technically part of the metric system.
You're killer pissing me off, Lackey. Eric, Speaker and Digressions writes, pet names. In the 90s, after I had moved out for higher education, my family had a cat named Colonel Fuzzbuttons.
Aww.
He also eventually went to live on a literal farm, along with his lover, a younger cat named Pretty Boy, after a parent decided they must be possessed by gay demons. This is the sort of parental decision that has kept me from moving back. I'll leave the tale there, since as you reminded us last month, it's the mystery that lingers.
Ah, yes.
Oh, man. That description, though, does sound like I'm at a film festival reading the synopsis of an indie film in the program, you know? The main character goes to live on a literal farm, along with his lover, a younger cat named Pretty Boy. After a parent decides they must be possessed by gay demons. I think I'm going to go see this after lunch.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Evan writes, I love the Steinhoffel shade, LOL. So when I said that if you go to a furniture store around here, the zombies come out, the salespeople zombies come out, I was talking about Steinhoffels.
Oh.
Now, Evan is from this Madison area. Okay. I think he's moved to D.C. or something like that, if I recall. But he knew specifically the place I was talking about. And I was talking about that store. I bought a couch from there, which is pretty amazing.
Oh, boy. And that gets us to feedback number 9, Cosmic Vampire Pig. Matthew Alderman writes, regarding Japanese foreign influences, what jumps to mind is that tempura is actually an adaptation of Portuguese fish dishes brought by Jesuit missionaries. Huh. Mm. That's cool. Jason Thompson writes, I think the best thing you could say about the gropey ghost in Gildea is maybe it's like a lonely child or a sad dog and it wants non-sexual affection. Ramsey Campbell did a semi-comedy story about a guy haunted by a dog once. Then maybe the advice, give it some love, makes sense. But yeah, it does feel sexual.
Yeah, give it some love. I'm not too sure about that solution. Joel Stottinger writes, ooh, I gotta throw my hat in the ring for Gilgamesh. While much of the original text has been recovered, whole chunks, especially in the final third of the story, are missing. This is a unique challenge to a reader and an interpreter of any skill level, and honestly, I as a listener would benefit from and love to hear your opinions and strategies for reading a broken, ancient, weird story. Mm. P.S. I think you'll especially enjoy a part the story of Gilgamesh where Gilgi finally finds the potential source of immortality and will be given that power if he can just stay awake for a certain number of days.
What?
This giant Conan-esque figure is slaying all sorts of giant monsters up to this point, and yet, he sleeps. Same. I do remember that part. I remember studying it in high school and being really fascinated by Gilgamesh and Enkidu. And
I don't know anything about Gilgamesh. For me, it would be...
We will definitely cover it.
That's awesome. Christine McCann writes, hearing the disturbing origin story for panpipes, I now really want to make some analog horror from those old Zamfir commercials. I'm not the only one old enough to remember those, right? You are not.
No.
I just went and looked up that video, and I felt like I was 10 years old again, or 12 years, however old I was. Those commercials were on all the time.
I had a memory when I read that comment, but didn't we use it for the show at some point? And actually went down my own rabbit hole. Uh-huh. Is that a phrase? Looking for, it was the great god Pan.
Uh-huh.
We introduced one of the episodes with the commercial.
Oh,
Zamfir, master of the Pan flute.
Okay, good.
So we've talked about it before, yeah. But those are definitely, man, they were on all the time on cable.
Yeah, and long.
It would be cool if there was a horror movie where those were included. Maybe it summons, you know, pierces the veil. Zamfir pierces the veil.
They're like 2-minute long commercials.
You hear a lot of panpipe music, yeah.
Now, Robbie H. writes, weird question for you two. How does one get into the movie industry without any experience, mainly production or any non-acting side of it? Is it just me screaming into the void, I want to help make a movie? Or is it just knowing the right people? Thank you in advance if you answered, and no issue if you didn't. Well, that's a good question, because I haven't been involved in making movies in 12 years. But what I would say initially is just wherever you're living, try to find people that are making movies and just volunteer to do whatever. And that's, you're in, just do that.
Yeah. The first question is, where do you live? If you're in a city, there's going to be tons of things going on.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in a smaller area, then it's probably the college, wherever the college is. But you always need people for a movie set.
Oh, yeah.
And the best thing you can do if you want to be in production is to be a production assistant. Then you'll be distributed to all sorts of departments and get to kind of get the idea of what everybody does.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody can break in. You don't have to know the right people.
No.
That gets us into study number 35, The Werewolf and the Vampire, part one.
Sanjay Matthew writes, back in 2002, before I went to the UK for my uni, my grandmother took me aside and darkly muttered, watch out for the English. They only bathe once a week. Wait, is he joking?
Leprawan says, I lived in London for 3 years in the early 70s as a kid. I can confirm that many adults bathed once a week and consider that normal.
Wow.
My British stepfather, a gentlemanly educator and crafter, bathed twice a week, religiously, despite not being religious. There was a bit of stuffy pong on the third day.
Wow.
Interesting to make this a fish out of water story instead of a rivalry like Underworld.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But no, I guess so. It seems normal, bathing once a week.
Right, yeah.
Underworld is so weird. Do you like those movies?
I liked the aesthetic of it. I watched the first one and the second one, but I don't really remember anything about it.
That's how I feel about it. I feel like Underworld is like you're dating and you cannot believe I landed the most unbelievably out of my league person.
Uh-huh.
Somehow to agree to go on a date with me.
Uh-huh.
And you go to dinner and go, I feel nothing. This is crazy.
What is wrong with me? Why do I feel
nothing? Everything looks right on the cover, but this person is just whatever. They're talking about things I don't care about.
Yeah.
Like something is not, there's no connection.
Yeah.
That's what Underworld's
like. Speaking of vampire, I remember when that movie came out, they tried to sue the production company for ripping them off. Do you remember that?
The Vampire the Masquerade?
Yeah, Vampire the Masquerade.
Role-play game,
yeah, uh-huh.
You can't have vampires and werewolves fight. Well, this points out, you know, sue Archette Wynne Hayes then.
Yeah, exactly.
So this stuff was already going on.
Jim Cannon writes, real Munsters vibe, yes. Did we not mention the Munsters?
I don't think we did,
Oh, my
no.
God, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
A Frankenstein marries a vampire and they have a werewolf for a kid, that kind of thing. Werewolves are infected, but vampires are born? What a weird setup.
It is. There are a lot of if you get into the rules of things and that,
yeah,
which I don't think the author would want you to, it gets confusing. Camshaft writes, very reassuring to learn. I'm not the only one who's been singing Revelations in Black on a loop for the past week.
Yep.
It's actually turned into the hook for a new song I'm writing.
Oh, wow.
I'll be sure to give credit on the album. You go right ahead. That's awesome.
That is rad.
I did just release the music from the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast,
yes.
Volume 3, a couple of weeks ago. But I was glad to get it out. And this wasn't on it because this I consider as part of the new show.
Oh, of course. Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to try and get these out a little more frequently than every 12 years, though. And so Revelations in Black will be out soon on Bandcamp
wow.
in the next year or two. Yeah, I'll build it out. What's funny, and I don't know if anybody spotted, is that the opening piano music for The Werewolf and the Vampire 1 and 2
mm-hmm.
is the piano adaptation of Revelations in Black. It's I actually adapted it to Wow. A different style.
That's great. You know, Graham Eberhart wrote, all of us who are in bands should write a song called Revelations in Black and then put it out as a compilation album.
I think that's a great idea, but I don't want to hear that. I'm doing a remix for Graham right now.
All right.
Well, I say I'm supposed to be doing a remix for Graham for Mayhem Lettuce.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, I've been updating my system, so I haven't been able to get to it yet. I can't get involved in doing this Revelations of Black cover album. That's on you, Graham. You got to run with that.
I understand.
Eric Gordon writes, calling the listeners strangers is great, but it has problems. How about Strangelings? Mm. Nils Hedgeland writes, I am more surprised that you have a producer than that one of your fans is the Strangler. We don't have a producer.
That was a joke.
Yeah, yeah. I wish we did.
Yeah, that'd be great. Sludgecrawler writes, what happened to doing Vampire City this March, Chad?
It was like too much to take on. I know. I talked about it like crazy last year. But I'm only a quarter into that book. I was reading it on the train when I moved, which was a year ago already last year. And it is out there, man. Like, it's really out there. So after doing all of the Robert Aichman, I kind of just wanted some A Veiled Woman in a Courtyard kind of old school Draculas.
Yeah.
Because Vampire City is, man. The vampires exist in many different places at once, and they're whole families of people, and they're automatons too.
What?
Yes.
Automaton vampires or just robots?
I don't know. It's crazy. Chris, I'm telling you, if you start reading this, it feels like you're going insane.
Oh, okay. I don't know if I want that. Maybe the exact opposite.
We'll get to it. We're definitely going to do it.
For next month, we are going to do The Island of Dr. Moreau. And that book is so effing awesome. It's so good.
Yeah. I think I'll get ahead a little bit and read maybe like the first quarter. And I read the whole thing.
It's a page turner.
Two sittings.
It's just one of those. He was so amazing. God. Anyway, that gets us to study number 36, The Werewolf and the Vampire, part 2. Hayden Orr writes, so glad Chad finally confronted Chris about his casual anti-monsterism. Just because you've got one friend who's a Frankenstein doesn't mean you get to pass on being ignorant. Please be better.
Oof.
I deserve that. It's true. I do need to be better. I need to try harder.
You've been watching 30 Rock lately, right?
I have been.
I love that in Werewolf Bar Mitzvah, how angry.com gets that he's saying Frankenstein's plural. Because it's not Frankenstein's plural. It's one person. Trey. Ethan Cordry writes, more seriously, I liked the discussion of domestic monsters being an analogy for civil rights movements. I agree that, like the X-Men, it's not a very good analogy to the racial equality movement. However, I think it might have more similarity to other movements, such as those for the acceptance of sexual minorities or religious minorities, groups whose behaviors and beliefs might shock the dominant majority culture. But an even better analogy might be with the movement to change perceptions of mental illness or disability. You know what? I agree with that.
Yeah.
Both werewolfism and vampirism can reasonably be viewed as forms of unchosen physical/mental disease. The werewolf undergoing involuntary physical transformation, the vampire having an involuntary compulsion to drink blood. The question in the story is whether these conditions can be accommodated or maybe even treated with a normal middle-class social life, or whether they must be stigmatized and repressed. George and Carolus seem to manage their conditions well and just want to live a typical middle-class family life and raise their child in peace. The Reverend is acting a bit like a eugenicist, believing that society needs to be cleansed from their monstrous taint. And he's especially horrified that they have reproduced, potentially polluting the gene pool.
And Chargoth Lord writes, the way the story ends really is a good show on how the ableists just assume disability, mental illness, and chronic illness are things that can't ever happen to them. And Joshua Weiss writes, two things. One, George and Carola come across as sympathetic because the story is being told by their grown-up werevamp son.
Wow.
I like that. In the framing story, he tells it as a tragedy of human/monster confrontation. All of the other monsters who are listening commiserate. Two, if we shift to the Reverend and the little boy as viewpoint characters, this could very well have appeared in the Tales from the Crypt. The Reverend discovers the monsters, but only one little boy believes him. They take matters into their own hands, and while they end the threat, they both end up incarcerated. The Reverend turning into a monster would have been the shocking final splash panel.
Yeah, absolutely. It was just a different viewpoint character on the same story, which was really cool.
Yeah.
One passionate advocate for cat-based space travel writes, I have no practical comment, but as I sit here at 7 a.m. on my Saturday, working on my PhD, which tragically has nothing to do with vampires or werewolves, I just wanted to say how glad I am that these shows let me think about nerdy stuff like this rather than healthcare messaging or concept analyses.
Aww.
Yeah.
I'm glad that we're doing that for you, and thanks for listening.
It's a Ghost writes, this story made me think about how people often interact with wolves and bats and other maligned animals. We see them as threats when in fact we're much more likely to be a threat to them. Mm. I'm excited for bats. You know, it's spring right now and bats will be coming back soon.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Derek Scott wrote, bats in particular eat non-Euclidean boatloads of mosquitoes, which should make them our best friends. Agreed.
Yeah, it really should.
Agreed.
Mm-hmm. More bats.
More bats, please. And that gets us to our extra credit. Number 9, a girl who walks home alone at night. Jeff C. Carter, oh, back on the show again.
Fighting his way in.
A girl walks home alone at night was fine, but there is way more skateboard snacking action in Thrashula.
Is that real?
That's not real.
Did you look?
I looked up. Well, yeah, there's no movie, as far as I could tell, called Thrashula. There should be.
I think it's funny that he both forced you to look and then me to have a discussion with you about it. Jennifer DeFord writes, I was looking in a bin of personal memorabilia recently and was reminded that I saved all the Soap Opera Digest recaps for the 1990s remake of Dark Shadows.
Wow.
That's awesome. I'm curious to see how the new version turns out. Was I excited about that on that last show?
I don't remember. I think you were just brought it up as it was something that was happening, and I was surprised. And I think
I guess if they do it right,
yeah.
You know, if they do a good job, it could be fun. But I do kind of, it's a filtered thing to begin with. The creator of the show was doing Jane Eyre at first and then kind of turned it into a Dracula, and then that caught on. But so they're already filtering these classic novels, and now it's been remade like 3 or 4 times. Hmm. I understand why people do existing IP. I do.
Sure.
Because it's so hard. Say, it took me 10 years to watch A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night.
Yeah.
If it had been called A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, Spider-Man 4, I would have watched it. You know,
right.
That's a clumsy title, but even nevertheless.
I would totally watch it.
I would have to see what that's all about. It's just hard to get a new thing into somebody's eyes.
Oh, I was at the bookstore the other day going through the graphic novel section, and what popped out to me was A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, graphic novel prequel to this movie written by the writer-director.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you get it?
I didn't pick it up, no.
Yeah, see? If it was like Girl Walks Home Alone at Night versus Ash.
Yeah, then I totally get it. No, I've been trying not to buy as many books because I'm a little off the hook right now. I've got so many books that I can't read. So if I'm not absolutely possessed to get something, then I don't get it. I try not to. So
I'm going to say that more to people. I'm going to go, I'm a little off the hook right now. But not be specific.
Oh,
I just
boy.
Want to warn you before we hang out, I'm a little off the hook right now. All right. What does that mean?
It's a Ghost writes, holy moly, I loved this movie. Like you guys, it kept my attention despite being slowish, black and white, in Persian, and I had no idea where it was going next. Here's a third meaning to the movie's title. She's a girl who walks home alone at night because she's simply alone. She doesn't have anyone else who cares about her. Yep.
No, yeah.
Yeah, of course.
We didn't bring that up. Yeah.
Good one.
You know, so he wrote LOOOVVVED for loved, which is why you said it that way. And I assume most people will understand that. But I wonder if there'll be like one listener who goes, we really had to sound that word out. Never seen the word loved before. Weird. Anne Knight writes, I'm looking forward to Robert Eggers' Nosferatu film coming out in 2024. Although I think Herzog's Nosferatu, The Vampire, is a perfect film. So it'll be interesting to see how they compare.
Confession time. I've never seen it. I've never seen Herzog's Nosferatu. Well, you haven't either.
No.
Oh, good. I don't feel so bad. Hey, there was a picture of it in that vampire book. Remember the one that was in our school?
Yeah.
And so I looked at it and was like, ooh, that looks cool. But then I never really, had access to it as a kid. It wasn't on TV very often because I think it was in German.
Yeah, I remember seeing it at the video store a lot and thinking maybe I'd get it. But the original Nosferatu was so impactful on me when I was little. And I guess I just was like, I don't need to see that in color. But I didn't know it was a perfect film, as Anne Knight puts forth.
So I'm going to have to rush out and try and find that somewhere. Sounds great.
But see, that's Robert Eggers makes such interesting original movies. I'm almost like, why are you doing a Nosferatu movie? Yeah. It's already great.
Yeah.
But again, because people will see it. He's probably tired of people not seeing his films.
Right.
I mean, everybody I know saw The Witch and The Lighthouse, but
Yeah.
You know, I go I didn't. Home for Thanksgiving. Nobody around that table has seen it. They wouldn't.
I didn't see either of those movies.
Right. They needed to be versus Ash. If you put versus Ash at the end of your title or versus
Spider-Man. I haven't seen one of his movies. And I feel like I should, obviously, because everybody says The Witch and The Lighthouse are perfect movies for me.
I don't know about that. You know what? The Witch, I'll throw my weight behind. You should check that one out. If you're going to take the time out, watch that. It's a slow movie. I think you'll really like it.
But The Lighthouse, you didn't like that?
Oh, I liked it, but I don't know.
It's not for me.
I just don't know if it's perfect for you.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
I'll take it.
He's a very talented filmmaker, though, and so I'll watch whatever the guy does.
Great. Well, I want to thank all of you guys for giving us some feedback. We appreciate it, and hopefully you enjoy our feedback of your feedback.
I hope so. And give us some feedback on this to let us know what you thought of our feedback on your feedback. And it'll be a feedback loop.
Woo!
That's all for this week. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
You have.
The Feedback Show.
Yes.
Exclusively on Patreon.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.